Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the first in the Department of Law's series of lectures on the rule of law. I say the department's lectures, but the department is not responsible on its own for the offerings that are being put before you. Those are very much a collaborative effort, and I should particularly like to thank, first of all, Justice for all that it has done to make possible this series of lectures, and to say how grateful we are to them, and how pleased we are to see Roger Smith, the director, here this evening. Secondly, to thank Clifford Chance, who have been responsible not only for sponsoring the lectures, something which any academic institution is always delighted to see, but also for a very active part in making them possible, setting them up, choosing speakers. And thirdly, to thank Ross Cranston, Professor Ross Cranston, QC, who is the person who took on the fairly formidable task of organising these lectures at my request immediately after rejoining the LSE. This is perhaps a particularly good opportunity for me to say how delighted we all are to have him back with us, now Parliament and the law officers have been able to spare him. Now, the lecture tonight is very much intended as part of a series, and I would encourage you to attend as many of them as possible. We have quite a good offering for you this term. On Wednesday, the 22nd of February, the Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, will talk about government and the rule of law in the modern age. With us is commentator Hawa Qureshi, a leading barrister in judicial review cases, practicing from Searle Court. Then on Wednesday, the 1st of March, at 6:30, Roger Smith of Justice will lecture on changing the rules, the judiciary, human rights and the rule of law. And the commentator that evening will be Baroness Hale, the law lord. And on Wednesday the 8th of March, the last lecture in the series this term, will be given by Shami Chakrabarti, the director of Liberty, on the theme terrorism and the rule of law, with Sir Sidney Kentridge QC as the commentator. Now, all three of the later lectures are held at the later time of 6:30, and in the Hong Kong Theatre rather than in this lecture theatre. But the Lord Goldsmith lecture, like this evening's, is a ticket-only event. Let me turn to tonight's lecturer and commentators. We're delighted to welcome this evening Lord Wolfe, the former Lord Chief Justice, as our guest lecturer. Lord Wolfe is perhaps better qualified than anybody else to lecture on the theme of democracy and the rule of law, because he started his career as a cavalry officer, and there is no better training for understanding what the rule of law is really all about. He went on from that to a career as at the bar, which included a five-year stint from 1974 to 79 as the first Treasury Junior Counsel in common law, the government's barrister, arguing every major judicial review case in that period, which I think we would all look back on as a seminal period for the development of public law, and indeed a seminal period for considering the whole concept of democracy and the rule of law. From there, he was appointed to the bench, where he's had a star-studded judicial career, including a term as Master of the Rolls, presiding over the Court of Appeal, and Lord Chief Justice, the position from which he stepped down at the end of last year. Our commentators this evening are Michael Smith of Clifford Chance, who is the head of the Public Policy Department of Clifford Chance, runs a charity for whistleblowing at work, and is also responsible for the firm's pro bono activities, activities which I know from my own experience are very considerable indeed. And secondly, Professor Nikki Lacey, who needs no introduction to most of you, professor here at the Law Department and author of an acclaimed and prize-winning biography of the leading jurisprude, Herbert Hart. And I'll now ask Lord Wolfe to give his lecture this evening, then call on the two commentators, and finally take some questions from the floor. Those of you who are attending the alumni dinner after this event, I promise you we will finish at 7:15, so you will be able to get up to the dinner in time for its start. Thank you all very much. Lord Wolfe.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very glad this occasion is associated with the alumni of LSE. As I look round this theatre, I believe I'm justified in saying that I'm a third alumni of LSE, though my home college is a place some of you have heard of called University College. But in my day, when you were taking a law degree at what was then very much London University, you visited King's, LSE, UC, and if you were much more energetic than I was, you also went down to Queen Mary's when it was always worthwhile once you got there. You've heard this is the first of the series of lectures. I'm afraid you've when I heard just now about the other lectures, I was very conscious that you have drawn the short straw, and I hope because of my lecture you're not put off attending the other lectures. At least you can be fortunate in knowing that because I'm under strict time restraints, I won't detain you too long. But this has been an amazing period in the development of the common law, and in particular of the surveying, supervision, whatever word you want to use, of the courts, of the activities of government. It's also been a most tremendous time of reform. Some of the reforms have been judge-made, and some of them have perhaps been made by counsel. I was reminded that I, for a period when I was Treasury Devil, I appeared in all or most of the very important cases. The fact that I lost most of them meant that the law developed, because Lord Denning developed the law on the basis of the submissions which failed to convince him that a different approach was not appropriate. And the growth of judicial review was one of the reforms that I was referring to. What was a huge development of the subjects upon which judges were required to adjudicate. And there was, at last, a recognition that it wasn't wrong to say that judges from time to time make law. There was also the new managerial role of judges in litigation. There was the Human Rights Act, devolution, the need to prevent, at times, parliamentary democracy descending into what some would describe as an elected dictatorship. And what was remarkable during all this period is that although the judges were, in a way, extending their role, at the same time, there was a very important partnership between the executive and the judiciary with regard to the running of the administration of justice in this case. There was a shared responsibility of the judiciary and the executive, which was developed and evolved, whereby both the judiciary and the members of what became now the Constitutional Affairs Department and what was, or Department of Constitutional Affairs, and what was then the Lord Chancellor's Department. And this was, I think, a very important part of our Constitution. And it, on the whole, worked remarkably smoothly. Sometimes what happened in court was not entirely smooth, but what was happening with regard to the administering the courts was improving all the time, and indeed improvement was needed. And this was part of a tradition of this country that our constitutional arrangements depended very substantially on a consensus. There was no clear parameters drawn out in any legislation, as to where the judicial responsibilities started and where they came to an end. And it was really a matter of feel, whereby a proper balance was kept by the between the role of the judiciary and the role of the executive. The source, of course, all went back to the fact that the judges today, as they have been since time medieval times, were the king or the queen's judges, depending on the gender of the monarch. And this tradition meant that the role of the judiciary was one which was influenced very much by tradition. I said to medieval times, because it was nearly another 9 years to go, 800 years ago, nearly 800 years ago, that Magna Carta came into existence. And that was a remarkable example of how constitutional change can take place within this jurisdiction, because, of course, Magna Carta was a compact or an agreement between the barons and King John, which was to have great significance thereafter, not only in this country, but indeed all around the globe. But the purpose of it was to enable the barons to safeguard their interests, which they saw as being threatened by the king. But although that was their target, in fact, they recorded in Magna Carta some of the fundamental principles that I believe are now to be seen absolutely basic parts of the rule of law. And although until relatively recently, and I will, before I sit down, perhaps bring you up to date on this, the concept of the rule of law was not elevated in our constitutional history. It is, in fact, a form of common law observance of the rule of law, which has been at the heart of our constitution. Now, everybody says today, of course, democracy is very important. But as we've seen in recent events, democracy by itself, if you buy democracy, you mean the election or a public vote, or general public vote, of those who are going to elect you, can produce very strange results. Democracy, I believe, involves, at its center, the rule of law. And when we talk about democracy, it has this dual facet. First of all, the government of the day has to be elected, preferably by universal suffrage. But secondly, the government that is elected must accept that it is subject to the rule of law. And in some of the comments which are being made because of recent events, the fact that the rule of law is such an important part of democracy is lost sight of, though it's not lost sight of in most of the round areas of the globe, whether you're talking about China or Russia or Hong Kong, where I'm going to be sitting as a judge very shortly. Those countries know that the observance of the rule of law is absolutely fundamental to their well-being. And if I had more time, I'd like to give you examples of that. But what is important is to realize that observance of the rule of law is becoming as powerful an influence in the development of nations as traditionally democracy has been thought to be. And there is an informal brotherhood between the judges of different countries who observe the rule of law, which enhances the concept, and it is an evolving concept, just in the same way as I would suggest democracy is evolving. And as part of that concept, usually, but not in this country, there has been a clearly defined separation between the judiciary on the one hand and the executive and the legislature on the other. But of course, until recently, the separation of powers has not been part of the English constitution. It has been a constitution where the whole of the exercise of power has been blurred because of a traditional figure, the Lord Chancellor, who combined his different roles, of which this audience is well aware. But that concept of separation of powers has now become much more evident. And why has that happened? It has happened because it has been appreciated that although there is undoubtedly a generally accepted principle of the sovereignty of Parliament, Parliament must also be, as in my view, subject to the rule of law. And if that is a right approach, then it is essential that there is a clear distinction drawn between the role of the judiciary and the role of the executive. Equally, of course, in order that Parliament can play its proper role, the role of Parliament has had to be identified. Now, while I accept that in general Parliament is undoubtedly sovereign, equally, I would suggest it must be accepted that Parliament has accepted qualifications for the time being in regard to its sovereignty in various respects. It has, first of all, accepted a limitation on its sovereignty arising out of our membership of the European Union. It has equally accepted limitations on its sovereignty because of our now having made the European Convention of Human Rights part of our domestic law. There has also been a devolution, and you can't have devolution without affecting Parliament's sovereignty, to this extent, at any rate, that there has to be a tribunal which can determine issues as to whether an issue is properly regarded as being devolved or not devolved. So these matters together create a substantial inroad on the sovereignty of Parliament. In addition, there have been cases recently where the courts have been called upon to rule on issues which do reflect on the sovereignty of Parliament. And a case which I feel reflects this is the case involving the banning of hunting, which came before the courts in the form of Jackson and the Attorney General. And that was a remarkable case to come before the courts, in my view, because what the courts were being called upon to do was to adjudicate upon whether legislation in 1949 had the effect which Parliament had treated it as having, without really any doubt until the hunting case came before the courts almost, over 50 years before, to pass by the legislation it did, the 1949 Act. That was the issue on which the House of Lords had to determine. And that was a quite a remarkable event. It was a remarkable event because it concerned the powers of the House of Lords. And the tribunal, which was the final authority on the powers of the House of Lords, without opposition by the government, indeed at the request of the Attorney General, was being determined by a court sitting in the House of Lords. And if anything persuaded me that it was time we had a separate Supreme Court, it was the realization that that really was not a satisfactory situation. And so you had cases like the Jackson case, which were bringing these issues for the first time before the courts, because if the courts didn't resolve them, nobody else could. And then we had, and I have to take a big jump to a different part of what I was going to say, because the clock is ticking on, we come to the announcement in June 2003 of the Prime Minister that Lord Irvine was going to be the last Lord Chancellor, and there was not going to be a Lord Chancellor in future. Instead, there was going to be a Secretary of State for Constitutional Affairs. Now, up till that time, the judiciary had always been content to have the Lord Chancellor as the constitutional head of the judiciary. Whereas this strange office of Lord Chancellor was acceptable as head of the judiciary, which involved with it the fact that the Lord Chancellor was the most senior judge in the land, the judiciary as a whole found it totally unacceptable that somebody who was a Secretary of State should be the head of the judiciary. And they made that clear in no uncertain terms. I don't believe, and I'm confident in not believing, that the constitutional significance of what the Prime Minister was doing was appreciated at the time that he made the announcement. Certainly the proposal that the Lord Chancellor should cease to exist was hastily revoked, and Lord Faulkner, Lord Irvine's successor, became Secretary of State and Lord Chancellor, because somebody had to perform the duties of Lord Chancellor until the situation was rectified. And the way that the judiciary played their part in bringing about that rectification was to engage in very heavy negotiation. We might have been helped by the presence of a mediator, but alas, there was not. We had to rely on doing it ourselves to negotiate for the first time what were and should be the responsibilities of the judiciary, and what should be the responsibility of the Lord Chancellor, and what should be the joint responsibilities. And this was done, and happily, it was possible to produce a what became known as a concordat, which was agreed between myself on behalf of the judiciary, with the backing of the judges' council, which represented the whole of the judiciary, excuse me, and the Lord Chancellor. And that document then became the foundation for the Constitutional Reform Bill, which became the Constitutional Reform Act of 2005. And although the Act does not reproduce all the provisions of the Concordat, it is totally consistent with the spirit of the Concordat, and it was announced at the time, and it's in the explanation for the Act, that it, parts 1 and 4 were covering the areas that are involved in the Concordat. It went further and dealt with the Supreme Court and matters of that sort, and also the future of the Lord Chancellor. But the critical thing was, we now have a document which was laid before both Houses of Parliament, which was not the subject of dissent by any political party, which contains a new consensus as to what things it's proper for the judges to do and what things are proper for the Lord Chancellor to do. And above all, and most importantly, there is now to be a new system of appointing the judiciary, a new grievance procedure, and both of them are designed so as to keep out any form of political influence. And you just need to think about what has been happening across the Atlantic in the United States and the political forces that are involved there, and contrast the situation here, where there was no political dispute as to who should be my successor, and where appointment was announced, it was accepted generally as it was the right appointment, to know how important that is to try and avoid controversy. Now, I know that there are to be commentators following me, so I must bring matters to an end. But before I do so, can I just draw attention to two provisions in the Constitutional Reform Act. Start at the beginning, Part 1, Section 1, and I quote, "The Act does not adversely affect the existing constitutional principle of the rule of law or the Lord Chancellor's existing constitutional role in relation to the principle." Now, there are a lot more people present, I'm sure, today who are much cleverer and much more knowledgeable than I am. But I believe that is the first real statutory recognition of the rule of law's role in our society, which is so important. So I think that Part 1, Section 1, is very important. Can I also draw your attention to what the next Lord Chancellor will have to swear? In addition to his traditional oath, he will have to swear, "I, new Lord Chancellor, do swear that in the office of Lord High Chancellor of Great Britain will respect the rule of law, defend the independence of the judiciary, and discharge my duty to support the courts for which I am responsible. So help me God." And I think that is, in that oath, is the core of what is the relationship between the Lord Chancellor and the judiciary. And then Section 3 goes on to say, "It's the duty of the Lord Chancellor and other ministers and all with responsibility for matters relating to judiciary or otherwise to the administration of justice to uphold the continued independence of the judiciary." So there is a framework on which I believe we can build the future, so that when these very controversial cases come before the courts, and politicians are tempted, as sometimes they are, when a case is decided in a manner which is not the one which they would have preferred, to challenge the propriety of the judiciary coming to the decisions that they do. This is a country where right at the heart of our constitution is the rule of law, and it's grown and come to play that part from over 800 years nearly since Magna Carta, and that is the justification for the judges deciding these difficult cases in the way which they believe that the rule of law requires. Thank you very much indeed.
Lord Rolfe, when you mentioned that your contribution to the development of judicial review through the cases that you argued unsuccessfully in the courts, elements of my own career flashed before my eyes as well. I now invite our first commentator, Nikki Lacey, to take up the theme.
Good evening, and thank you. Thank you, Chris. I wanted to really pick up on one point in Lord Rolfe's very rich address. Having to do with he mentioned the somewhat complex relationship between democracy and the rule of law. We often hear these used and phrased together, but of course, as he reminded us, one can have although one can have one without the other, arguably neither is really worth having unless combined with the other. But democracy and the rule of law, I think all too often, belong in a sort of rhetorical phrase. And what I wanted to suggest this evening is that we might be able to get something out of a little reflection on exactly what's required by the rule of law, what kind of ideals the rule of law stands for, to foresee what its future might be in some of the sorts of cases which Lord Wolfe was speaking about. So the rule of law, we have certain statutory indicators of what it might mean. For example, the Human Rights Act, the European Convention's definition of the principle of legality. We have the Concordat, which Lord Wolfe was mentioning. But I'd like to suggest that we can go further than this. Of course, having the rule of law is very much more than having an established legal order with an independent judiciary. The independence of the judiciary, of course, is an absolutely key thing. But the history of the 20th century shows that there are a number of safeguards, really, that coalesce to provide a rule of law that is genuinely worthy of the name. And in this context, I think it's actually worth revisiting very briefly a famous debate from the 1950s between two of the most famous jurists of the English-speaking world in the 20th century, Herbert Hart and Lon Fuller. Now, I'm going to let you into a secret here. When Michael and I were conferring this afternoon about how we might approach our respective commentaries, and I said that I thought I might use some legal theory, he roared with laughter. Now, he's a busy chap, so I didn't cross-examine him as the source of his mirth, but I do hope to persuade you in the next few minutes that Fuller's idea of what he called the inner morality of law is actually quite an inspiration in thinking about the complexity and the many different dimensions of the ideal of the rule of law. Now, the debate which Hart and Fuller had, and which ended up in the pages of the Harvard Law Review, was really coming out of the terrible legacy of the use of law in Nazi Germany. And the nub of their debate had to do, as most of you will know, with a debate about whether it was appropriate to take the view, as Hart did, that Nazi law and other forms of evil law are genuinely law, yet too evil to be obeyed, as opposed to the view defended by Fuller, which is that rather we should only regard as genuinely legal systems which live up to what he called a certain inner morality. Now, I'm not so bothered about that particular debate. What I'm interested in is Fuller's idea of this inner morality of law. The inner morality of law is the lecturer's nightmare. I try to avoid it in my own jurisprudence teaching because there are no fewer than 8 canons of the inner morality of law, according to Fuller, and I'm afraid that I've never been able to remember more than 6 of them in any one class, so I did take the trouble to actually write them down for this evening. But Fuller's argument about the so-called inner morality of law actually equates very closely with aspects that most of us will probably be more familiar with under the rubric the rule of law. So what does he have to say about this inner morality? His 8 canons include some fairly familiar requirements. Law should not be retroactive. It should be of general application. It should be publicised. It shouldn't be contradictory. And it should be possible for those to whom it is addressed to comply with it. Those might seem fairly straightforward. But there are other requirements which are perhaps more intangible. Certainty, clarity, and interestingly, constancy of law through time, and congruence between declared rule and official enforcement. Now, in this country, we do enjoy boasting about our adherence to rule of law ideals, and we often compare ourselves, perhaps somewhat unself-critically, with less civilized countries which we hold to ignore these ideals. But when we look clear-sightedly at contemporary English law, how confident can we be that these standards are truly met? As a criminal lawyer, I would have to conclude that there isn't too much cause for complacency, even if there is some basis for pride. If we take, for example, the quite extraordinary welter of new criminal justice legislation which emerges from Westminster each year, I think this in itself casts some fairly serious doubt on our capacity to meet Fuller's ideals of clarity and certainty. But I also think that in so hugely and inexorably expanding criminal law scope, we're reducing the possibility of regular or even-handed enforcement and increasing the scope for potentially arbitrary official discretion. As for constancy of law through time, we surely score quite poorly. Our law is, of course, technically open to public scrutiny, but there are, as it were, substantive questions about how genuine people's access is according to their, as it were, social and financial position, how without education, without perhaps these days access to the internet or at least to a library, it can be quite difficult to find out what the law is. And let's face it, how many of us, even legal specialists, have the time to inform ourselves about the vast range of modern legislation. In areas such as taxation, even retrospective applications of law aren't unheard of. And of course, Jeremy Bentham, scion of Lord Wolfe's alma mater and indeed mine, was famous for thinking that the common law itself was little more than a sort of institutionalized system for the dignification of retrospective judicial lawmaking. The anti-terrorism legislation declared by the House of Lords in the Belmarsh case to be incompatible with the Human Rights Act violated the requirement of generality by targeting foreign nationals. So what I want to suggest is that on an adequately rich, multi-layered conception of what it means to respect the rule of law, we shouldn't be complacent about how far we're respecting it in this country. And we have every reason to think that the court's role, which, like Lord Wolfe, I celebrate, of policing the rule of law in a rich sense through the parameters of the Human Rights Act, will have a very interesting and lively future. But of course, I'm not meaning to suggest that the English legal system, even before the Human Rights Act, ignores the rule of law. And there are many features of our system of which we can be justly proud. The Belmarsh case, like other notable Human Rights Act decisions, some of them mentioned by Lord Wolfe, has made, it seems to me, a real improvement to our capacity to meet rule of law ideals. And this brings me back, finally, to another insight of Fuller's. For Fuller, the inner morality of law, his term for the rule of law, was not a zero-sum matter. It was what he called a morality of aspiration, a set of ideals which no system could reach perfectly, but one whose achievement is a matter of degree and to which every legal system worth the name aspires. The rule of law, in other words, should be regarded as a continuing source of critical inspiration for lawyers and indeed for citizens. In a way, we could think of it as the conscience of a legal order. And I think in that sense, it's most appropriate that we should be exploring as well as celebrating it in this series of lectures. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dickie. And now our second commentator, Mr. Michael Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nicky, I assure you my giggle, which I do acknowledge was the nervous harumph of the condemned man. I don't know, ladies and gentlemen, about the rule of law, but the sight of your sponsor this evening, required as he is to respond on an extemporary basis to one of the finest judicial minds of any generation is surely a paradigmatic example of the law of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. And I feel an expert in that subject, and perhaps there'll be an honorary fellowship for me at some stage from LSE. Now, I'm tempted to seek relief from your chairman, veteran of so many Strasbourg applications as he is, and ask him to secure for me some equality of arms under my Article 6 rights. But Nikki set the ball up for me rather nicely in saying that much of the debate about democracy and the rule of law has traditionally been couched in rhetorical terms. And like any toiler at the legal vine, I propose not to talk about those areas in respect to which I know nothing, but to say a little about some subjects by dint of personal experience as a private practitioner, about which I may be able to offer a view. And I'd like, therefore, to drill down from Fuller's 8 points, as articulated by Nicky, and the observations his lordship made about the rule of law, by featuring some practical issues which face me as a practicing lawyer, and most important of all, consumers of legal services, otherwise known as clients. The first of these is that aspect of the rule of law which involves access to justice. Now, we've referred to this briefly tonight. Before you have access to justice, you need access to advice. And we must all, whether practicing lawyers or judges or parliamentarians, be vigilant to ensure that people governed under law, whether or not in a democracy, have access to advice. And I'm uncertain as to whether that's necessarily the case in this country. Nicky referred to people who may not have internet access. Whether or not they've got internet access, do they have access to a lawyer? I confess to being surprised that so few, if any, government ministers proclaim the one of the salient and most enduring features of the Attlee administration, which had been the establishment of a comprehensive system of civil legal aid in this country. It seems to me that's much more a piece of Labour architecture than the National Health Service. And yet very rarely do I hear members of the present administration talking with pride of that achievement. And that may not be unconnected with the fact that our access regime, which we seek to confer for people who would otherwise not have access to a lawyer through a comprehensive system of civil legal aid, is under considerable pressure. Now, it may be thought surprising that that point of view should be articulated by a partner at Clifford Chance, but it bears directly on the activities of lawyers in my firm, because there's an increasing extent to which that unmet legal need is being taken up by lawyers free of charge and in the public interest. And that's a very good thing. There's always been unmet legal need. Whatever system of funding is devised will still leave some people short of paid legal advice. But I can identify from my own experience in my own firm an exponential connection between the termination of legal aid franchises in the East End of London and the increasing need imposed on rich, well-resourced, successful law firms to take up the slack. And that's an area in respect of which we have to, I think, exhibit great care in analysing the health of our system of law. Even if you have access to advice, you need to make sure that access to justice in terms of your ability of end users to go to court is also secured. And in that regard, you've got to take care to ensure that the entry requirements aren't set too high. And therefore, I think we in our respective capacities here have to take care to ensure that we look closely at the government's proposals this year to ensure that litigants, parties to litigation, pay trial fees, whereby the time of judges will be paid for by the hour. Now, that's a system that's familiar to those who engage in arbitration, but at the top, rich end of the litigation market, the government needs to realize that capital is mobile, clients are mobile, and clients might just determine that rather than pay in addition for the services of a high court judge, they'd rather pay for an arbitrator in Amsterdam or Paris or wherever. And this seems to me to bear on the rule of law. More importantly, of course, is the entry requirements posed for people at the bottom, who may find that the fee currently charged for some applications which involve an injunction of up to £1,200 is perhaps a disabling requirement, preventing them securing access to justice. So those are practical features of the rule of law which I meet constantly in my area of practice. I was very struck by what Nikki said about the predictive and certain qualities of law as being a feature of the health of rule of law. I agree with that. There is a view that the quality of drafting in our legislation isn't what it was. I'm much too young to offer a comparative comment on that, but I rely solely for that proposition on the observation of the Master of the Rolls, Lord Phillips, in a part of the Naomi Campbell litigation when he said that the Data Protection Act was a cumbersome and inelegant piece of legislation. And that's relevant in terms of what we're discussing tonight, because the business end of the legal services market actually worries more about law that's unclear and uncertain, often much more than the substance of the law involved. And therefore, corporate clients of a firm like mine are often fatigued and bemused where, as appears increasingly to happen, legislation, whether emanating from Brussels or Westminster, is opaque. It's also important, I think, in terms of Lord Wolfe's comments about the balance to be struck between the executive and the legislature and the judges, that one limb of that troika doesn't behave capriciously. One saw a good example of that recently when the Lord Chancellor, when the Chancellor of the Exchequer, rather, announced in November that the proposal to introduce operating and financial reviews of British public companies, whereby they would be required to report prospectively about issues affecting the environment and the like, would be dispensed with. This after regulations had been laid, this after there had been widespread consultation on the subject for at least 5 years. And last week we witnessed the Treasury agreeing to pay the costs of Friends of the Earth, who made a judicial review application in respect of the Chancellor's announcement. It's an odd feature of the rule of law in sophisticated societies that corporate clients are often more happy to have regulation which is applied consistently and comprehensively than a completely unregulated market in respect of which they lose market share to the opportunists and those who are less scrupulous. So, albeit from a parochial perspective, I endorse entirely what Nikki has said about indispensable features of our system being certainty and a lack of opacity. I've said very little about democracy. Plainly, lawyers can earn a living, perhaps not thrive, but earn a living in systems that aren't necessarily democratic. My own firm has offices across the globe and in a number of jurisdictions that couldn't remotely be described as democratic. But it's equally clear that the ability of lawyers to thrive is most obviously consistent with the development and existence of democratic standards. London has a thriving entrepreneurial legal industry. It's got a world-beating capacity in that regard. The same is not the case in a number of other jurisdictions. And it's interesting and I think wholly appropriate that Kofi Annan and the G8 leaders have made the promulgation of the rule of law an indispensable feature of the Millennium Goals. It seems to me there's a clear nexus between democracy and trade and the development and enhancement of the rule of law. And at the risk again of sounding parochial, I think the opening up of legal markets worldwide would be a good short-term mechanism to enhance those standards. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. Now I'm going to take some questions from the floor. I'm going to gather up a number of questions and then invite our lecturer and our commentators to respond to them. Three golden rules, please, about asking a question. First of all, wait for the microphone. There are roving microphones being taken around the room. The acoustics in this theatre are not particularly good if you're speaking from the floor. Secondly, please begin by identifying yourself. Please do this even if you are so famous, you know everyone will recognise you anyway. Even the most famous are difficult to recognise from behind, and this may save you the humiliation of knowing that you're not as well recognised as you think you are. And the third question is, please put a question to the panel rather than making a speech. And one question, not an exam paper, if you'd be so kind. So who would like to ask the first question? Yes, sir, at the back.
Thank you. Ollie Stoneley from the BBC News website. When the when you have a Prime Minister who talks about changing the rules of the game, how much is there a danger that democracy in the shape of a democratically elected government can actually alter the rule of law, and how much can judges in the courts do to prevent that happening?
Thank you very much. Next. Yes, over here, please.
G. Leslie, surely with the commentator's mention of the replacement of legal aid by no win, no fee and the disappearance of legal aid lawyers, we have a direct challenge, rather, we have a direct denial of justice, access to justice to many people, so that surely the rule of law is put in doubt by this. I'd also invite Lord Wolfe to talk about more detail what he meant by the rule of law becoming increasingly significant in Hong Kong, China and Russia.
Thank you. And a third question. Anybody in the gallery? Yes, over there please, Professor Davis.
Does that mean I don't have to say who I am?
I just said it for you.
Thank you. A question for Lord Wolfe. I understood him to be in favour of the separation of powers, but I wasn't quite sure that he was so much in favour of the abolition of the office of Lord Chancellor. But I wondered whether those two things weren't consistent with each other rather than inconsistent with each other.
Thank you. I've got time, I think, for two more. Yes, the lady at the back there, please.
Ilana Marchant, solicitor. I was wondering whether the panel could comment, please, on attempts by the government to withdraw rights from foreign nationals within our jurisdiction. You've mentioned the Belmarsh case. I was also thinking of attempts to oust the right of appeal to the Court of Appeal in immigration matters under the 2004 Act.
Thank you. And one final question. Yes, the lady in the middle there. Most inaccessible position for the roving microphone, but it will get to you.
Hi, Melissa Bobick, Treasury Solicitor, lawyer. I was just wondering, a question for Lord Wolfe. When he mentioned the informal brotherhood between judges of developing countries, In circumstances where the rule of law is not so much not as apparent within courts of those countries, how do you suggest is best for society or the international community to sort of encourage steps forward in regards to respecting rule of law?
Thank you very much. I'll ask Lord Wolf to respond first, please, and then our two commentators.
Well, they're a really formidable set of questions, and they could be the series, could be the basis of a series of lectures by somebody more able than myself. But let me change, let me try and give a global answer to the questions. I have them all written down, so I'm going to do my best without taking up too much time. I think that one of the critical features of this country's protection of the rule of law and our democracy has been the fact that we have had a tradition of mutual respect, that the judiciary exercises restraint, which I believe they should do, and don't bring themselves into conflict with other arms of government unless it is essential to do so, having regard to the case that comes before them. If there is a case where it is necessary to take positive action, then you must not be deterred from doing that if you're a judge, because it would be inconsistent with your responsibilities, because it does have an impact on the other arms of government. But you can seek, where possible, to do it in a way which will not cause unnecessary friction between the different arms of government. And so I put that statement right at the forefront, bearing in mind the first question that was advanced to me about changing the rules of the game. And then, if I may, can I come up and take as an example of what I mean in relation to the question which was based on the Immigration Act, which thankfully does not contain the clause which the bill contained, which was to prevent those who were within its grasp from applying to the court. Now, I saw that personally, and I made it clear at the time, so I don't mind repeating it now, as an overt challenge to the rule of law. And in my view, it was particularly unfortunate because I regarded it as being unnecessary. And I think that what has happened since has shown it to be unnecessary. But that was just the sort of provision which could put the judiciary in a position where they would have to pronounce upon an issue which it is much better is left somewhere in the ether to be drawn down if and when, regrettably, it's necessary. And I feel that there is then a responsibility on the executive, who is, and Parliament, if it comes to legislation, to look at the consequences of what is proposed and recognize the importance of maintaining the hugely valuable qualities of our unwritten constitution, which means that it has the flexibility to evolve to meet the needs of our citizens from time to time. Now, in countries like Russia, China, and Hong Kong, they have become very conscious of the importance of the adhering to the rule of law, because they realize that in a time when we have a global economy, they will only achieve for their citizens what they wish to achieve if those from other countries who are considering investing and helping to develop those countries believe that they can do so with a sense of security, that they will be protected by the rule of law in those countries in the same way as they would in their own countries. And it's my belief that Hong Kong has been extraordinarily wise, not because I'm due to go there and sit on their final court of appeal, but to recognize that because of the special position of one country, two systems, of having a judicial system which looks and is, in fact, independent. Well, I don't believe by having an overseas judge always sitting there actually affects the independence of the Hong Kong judiciary. I believe that it's a judiciary of high quality, which is independent in the same way as our own. But the fact that they rather magnanimously allow a judge from overseas to always sit on their final court of appeal is a guarantee, a message of guarantee, that we are intending to observe the rule of law and that we fact do so. And it gives confidence to those who trade with Hong Kong to know the type of country that they are dealing with, part of the China. And I can only say, based on my visits to China over a period of 20 years, it is extraordinary the developments that have taken place. Now, their approach to the rule of law depends upon the fact that they are what they call a socialist democracy, which is a different type of democracy to ours. And it's also true, as Beijing will acknowledge, that its control of the different parts of that very large country are imperfect. But nonetheless, rightly or wrongly, I believe that when they talk, as they do, now increasingly of the importance of observing the rule of law, including human rights, they mean it. Now, countries don't change automatically overnight. A system has to develop. But I do believe that that is the direction in which they're moving, and I think it is a very important fact. And perhaps less perfectly, the same thing, I believe, is happening in Russia. There are disturbing events that are taking place in that country, which worries all those who wish it well. Because what is true of Hong Kong and China, and is, in my belief, also true of China. Finally, if I may just come to the question of access to the courts, I regard that as being the greatest importance. And I do believe, and it's been said by colleagues and it's been said by myself, the myth, because that's what it is, that our civil justice system can be self-financing, is really leading us to taking decisions which are not in accord with our traditions. And just as worry was expressed by my colleague, so I would express worry about some of these implications. And just as he expressed concern about the disappearance of the really extraordinarily good system of legal aid that we had, so I would share his views. And one can only hope that times will change and we can start regaining some of the ground that has been lost. Having said that, I have to acknowledge and recognize that unfortunately our legal system is very expensive. And other countries have managed to provide legal services in a more simple way, which means that the expense is not so great. And I make that acknowledgement because I recognize there is only a limited amount that can be of resources that can be made available to any legal system. And the government has been driven into taking steps which I am uncomfortable about, because the legal aid budget was undoubtedly out of control. And I think it is very important that we find other ways of doing things which are more economical and cheaper, while ensuring that our Rolls-Royce system, because it can still be a Rolls-Royce system, is available with all its complications in those cases, but only those cases where it's required.
Thank you very much. Nikki.
Just one very brief comment, if I may. Again, like Lord Wolfe, I saw a link between the first question and the, I think it was the fourth or fifth question, the one about the right of appeal. I'm inclined to think that the nub of the problem here was very succinctly summarised by Lord Hailsham in an article, in the title of an article published about 30 years ago, which was called Elective Dictatorship. I think that the structure of our particular democratic institutions are such that the checks and balances work best when the government doesn't have too big a majority. And I think that's what we're seeing in this particular version of the Labour government. So I think that the Human Rights Act and the expanded possibility for judicial scrutiny is one thing that can be helpful, but I don't think that's ever going to be a complete solution.
Thank you very much. And Michael, you get the last word, apart from my summing up.
Well, I think my views on the legal aid system were reasonably clear, and I needn't refer to that again. In response to the first question as regards whether or not the Prime Minister, by saying the rules of the game have changed, has perhaps exhibited some indication that the executive is out of control. I don't know, but you could only say in response to that that we've been well served by our senior judges over the last couple of years in stunning enunciations of the position as they see it in relation to torture and detention. They've presumably at a stroke rewritten the first chapter of the constitutional law primers that undergraduates here are studying. It's also interesting what's happening in the legal profession, because whereas in the past, I think I'm safe in saying it would have to be acknowledged that campaign groups such as Liberty came out of a left of centre part of the political spectrum. Events of the last couple of years have forged all sorts of hitherto strange alliances and connections within the legal profession, both here and abroad. I think the profession has exhibited clear concern about numbers of these issues, and I think that's been a wholly democratic thing for our discourse, and not just in the UK. You've got Louise Arbour at the UN Human Rights Commission making very, very clear pronouncements as to torture. And I think whether or not the executive is untrammeled, it's quite clear, and I think they increasingly recognize that there are strong and powerful and articulate voices who don't share their views.
Thank you very much. Well, I think, ladies and gentlemen, we've been treated to a most enjoyable and stimulating hour and a quarter of discussion about what must be one of the most topical and difficult questions of our time. What I particularly draw from it is the fact that as lawyers, as I think most of this audience are, we need to go away thinking about the rule of law not so much as the fire burning in the hearth which keeps us warm in a sort of complacent little fug at night, which is all too often the way that lawyers in this country do talk about it, but rather as the fire burning at our feet and in danger of consuming everything, a challenge which has got to be met by all of us who practice in the legal profession, as academics, as practitioners, as judges, and that it's just as much a responsibility in terms of ensuring access to justice as it is ensuring the quality of that justice when you have got access to it. It's just as much a matter of ensuring clarity and consistency in the drafting and application of law as it is a matter of upholding the rather sexier topics of independence and values. And perhaps above all, it's a matter of ensuring that the term Rolls-Royce is what we think of when we think of the system, rather than what we think of when we think about the senior partner or head of Chambers's car. Will you join me, ladies and gentlemen, in thanking very much Lord Wolfe and our other speakers?